Cool. And speaking of Ali Molly, I'm just going to introduce Ali now. Ali's a long-term social alternative activist here in Sydney, currently a kind of student organiser at UNSW. She's spent the last few years doing a lot of research into questions of economics from a Marxist perspective, and so she's going to be giving a bit of an introduction today on the question of protectionism and free trade. So everyone make Ali welcome.
All right, well, over the past few months, there has been a pretty serious resurgence of mainstream discussion and debate over free trade versus protectionism. And this, quite obviously, follows the re-emergence of some high-profile economic nationalist political parties, and more specifically, Trump's the whole series of tariffs that Trump has been slapping on countries around the world since January this year. So this has also rehashed debates on the left about protectionism, mainly the question of whether or not tariffs are a progressive alternative to neoliberal free trade that can boost the employment, that can boost employment levels and the wages of workers within a nation's economy. So some high-profile examples espousing this view recently have been the AFL-CIO, which is the peak trade union body in the United States. The Bernie Sanders campaign also made this a pretty prominent feature. And some of the unions in Australia based around industry, like the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. It's worth saying, though, that this is not actually a new debate. Calls for tariffs, amongst other economic nationalist demands, have been a fairly firm feature of social democracy and the reformist trade union bureaucracy. And more recently, these organisations have taken up the call for tariffs in response and in relation to China. So I'm going to argue that neither of these strategies, so neither protectionism nor free trade, should be taken up and encouraged by the left and the workers' movement. Both free trade and protectionism are mechanisms that are used by the state to progress the interests of capital, not workers, throughout different phases of capitalism. And I'm going to spend the rest of this talk kind of giving an explanation or a justification for that position. So I'm going to start with going through a just kind of brief ruling class history of how protectionism and free trade have been utilised at different phases throughout the development of capitalism. So obviously free trade has been essentially capitalist religion for the past four decades. So unregulated markets and the free movement of capital have both been pretty serious ideological and economic pillars of neoliberalism. But it's worth saying that this has not always been the case. At times, protectionism has actually been the order of the day in the eyes of a majority of the ruling class when this was going to be generally beneficial to the overall interests of a nation's capital. So countries who will be the strongest trading partner in trade deals due to their kind of economic and technological advantages, they have tended to favour free trade policies as they stand to gain more from those who they are trading with. So after 1840, the United Kingdom, which at that point was the world's largest economic and military power, they favoured free trade, removing a whole series of barriers and tariffs to trade, most notably the repeal of the Corn Laws. But once British manufacturing was being outstripped on global markets by new economic rivals in the United States and Germany, there was a kind of steady move back towards protectionism. And then conversely, the United States remained very committed to protectionism and quite substantial tariffs throughout the 19th and the early 20th centuries. And it was only once their industrial competitors had been pretty much all but wiped out by World War II that they opened their markets and became the main global proponent of free trade. There's also been a historical link between protectionism and rising imperialist tensions. So in the lead up to, or during a drive to, towards war, protectionism has been established as a way of building up a nation's kind of national industrial strength. So as imperialist tensions were growing in the late 19th century, a whole series of countries began to reintroduce tariffs. So most notably were France in 1892 and Italy in the mid 1880s. Did I say 1892? Yeah. So Lenin and Bukharin, in their writing on imperialism, they explained this dynamic as the growing integration between monopoly capital and the state. In that relationship, the state is trying to protect and grow national capital, in particular heavy industry, at a time when the European powers were growing in hostility to one another, eventually breaking out in the mass destruction of World War I. And also a similar dynamic can be seen in the lead up to World War II. It's somewhat false to present these two things as entirely counterposed methods. In reality, a combination of the two approaches to trade is employed depending on the needs of each industry and the kind of general level of development of a nation's economy. For example, in the East Asian newly industrialising countries in the post-war period, the infant industry strategy, which was a strategy that used trade policy to help new industries develop, which would otherwise be hindered by international competition. This strategy used a combination of tariffs and tariff subsidies, mainly on raw materials used in exporting. These were used alongside other methods of state intervention into the economy, as well as a kind of open, kind of unregulated trade with some of the more powerful countries, depending on what were the kind of key sections of industry. So today, the capitalist class on the whole is still largely united behind the free trade agreements and policies that were established over the past few decades. This kind of whole system has been referred to a lot recently in the media as the global rules-based order. But there's an increasingly powerful section of the right, most notably represented by Trump, who have been demanding a return to economic nationalism. So this has obviously become highly explosive this year, beginning with Trump's tariffs on, well, actually Trump's tariffs at the start of the year on some form of renewable energy, and I've just forgotten the other thing, but it really exploded when he introduced tariffs on steel and aluminium, and then rolled out a whole series of other tariffs, mainly against China, and then in turn with the response from those affected countries. So I think that we should very much see Trump's strategy or Trump's use of tariffs as fitting quite firmly within his strategy of combating the increasing rise of China and the threat that that poses to US global hegemony. Okay, now I want to spend a bit of most of the time actually talking about protectionism and why I think the left should not adopt this as a key strategy. I think that free trade is kind of the less controversial aspect out of these two, especially when you look at the kind of devastating effects of neoliberalism 40 years on. I'll talk a little bit about that later, but I'm going to mainly focus on protectionism. So left-wing proponents of tariffs argue that the only way to protect jobs in the face of international competition, they argue that tariffs are the only way to protect jobs in the face of international competition that will force domestic employers to shut down shop. Anyway, so left-wing proponents of tariffs, they argue that in the face of big international competition from, you know, low-wage growth models, etc., that threaten an industry and their ability to continue operating, the only way to curb that is to put tariffs on imports from that industry combined with a series of other demands based on economic nationalism. For instance, with the auto industry in Australia requesting that the government grant massive bailouts to stop them from shutting down, etc. Bernie Sanders, I think, is a really good example of this recently. He made this kind of economic nationalism a serious plank of his election campaign throughout 2015 and 2016. So he kind of rightly recognised that the living standards for American workers have declined substantially over recent decades. There's whole towns in America that once had near full employment that are now, you know, destitute from street to street, and that wages have gone down, the cost of living has gone up, etc. And his answer to these problems was to say that the government needs to intervene to give a boost to American industry to try stop the flow of cheap imports arriving from overseas, with the intention that that will then prop up American companies, mining, etc. There's also heaps of examples of this strategy used in Australia over the past few decades in response to the effects of neoliberalism. So the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union has run a few campaigns that relate to this. Doug Cameron, who some people might know as a key figure of the Labor left in Parliament. He was the secretary for the Manufacturing Workers Union in the late 90s. He ran a campaign called Fair Trade, Not Free Trade, where he said that tariffs should be selectively applied on imports that come from countries that use very low wages in their production methods. But also in the 1980s, when there was a serious assault on the Australian working class, there were campaigns run by the unions covering like the auto industry, textiles, clothing and footwear industries, demanding that tariffs be increased. Also, just I think kind of general slogans like Aussie jobs for Aussie workers have become more and more a feature of the way people talk about protecting Australian industry. So recently, this strategy has fallen quite squarely in line with the so-called, it's now gaining a level of hysteria, but the so-called threat of China. So in 2015, the ACTU campaigned really hard against the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement on the basis that it would undermine Australian sovereignty and that many, many thousands of Aussie jobs would be lost to Chinese workers. And it was put that explicitly. There were a series of advertisements on TV from the Electrical Trades Union. There was a big rally in Sydney run by the ACTU, which was all about Australian workers losing out to the Chinese. So that's kind of a overview of how this is a feature of, or how this has been a feature of social democracy and trade union movements. Just want to now go through a few main points about why I think this is wrong. So, firstly, I think that tariffs, or the call for tariffs, don't actually even achieve what they are supposedly set out to do. So, they do not actually save jobs or maintain wages at a certain level. So there is no substantive evidence that suggests free trade policies have been the direct causal factor leading to a decline or a substantial decline in jobs, or that inversely, erecting tariffs would bring those jobs back. So Michael Roberts, who's a Marxist economist with a blog called The Next Recession, he's done a bunch of research into the kind of free trade policies and the effect of the working class in the United States. So he argues that the argument about whether free trade or increased tariffs will be better for American workers misses the mark. He argues it is not free trade policies that have been the source of most job losses, and tariffs will not bring them back. Instead, it has been an increase in productivity and the rate of exploitation that has created job losses, wage cuts, and deteriorating workplace conditions. So Roberts draws on research from the Keynesian economist Paul Krugman and explains that competition from China led to the loss of 985,000 manufacturing jobs between 1999 and 2011. That sounds like quite a lot, but it's actually less than a fifth of the absolute loss of manufacturing jobs over that period, and is actually quite a small share of the long-term manufacturing decline. So Roberts also explains that manufacturing output was at an all-time high in the United States in 2015. So just to explain that, there's not been this massive decline of the manufacturing industry. There's still a high level of output. What there has been a decline in is jobs. Also, over the kind of neoliberal period, there have been a total of 7 million jobs lost in manufacturing. So again, you can see jobs are being lost. That many jobs are being lost at a time when more stuff was being produced than ever. But to find an explanation for this, I think we have to go back to what I said about increases in productivity. So in 2017, the average American manufacturing worker produced 300% more than their counterpart did in 1979. The reason for this is that developments in machinery, automation, etc., that have massively increased the output per worker, this combined with a neoliberal offensive that has, you know, just sacked loads of workers, pushed the work that those people did onto the remaining workers, that's also relocated industry to the poorly, not necessarily offshore, but to the poorly unionised south of America, where the bosses can get away with paying people less and making people work harder and harder. And that it's kind of these attacks on wages and conditions that has increased the rate of exploitation. This is also true for the steel industry in the US. To produce one tonne of steel today takes each worker an hour and a half. This is compared to more than 10 hours for that same tonne in 1980. So even if tariffs were to give somewhat of a small boost to local industry, there is no evidence to suggest that this would lead to substantially more jobs. Even where there is growth in a certain industry, it's not leading to, it's not necessarily leading to more jobs. And this same general dynamic exists here in Australia. Tom Bramble did a whole lot of research into the tariffs or the kind of cut down of tariffs in the 1980s and 1990s in the manufacturing industry, and kind of found that for each X amount of dollars that was directed out of Australia into another country, there was the same, if not more, amount of dollars that was gained back into the country by foreign direct investment. Also, that most Australian money that was being invested overseas was not actually going towards, you know, the sweatshops in the south of China or other places like that, but was going to other advanced Western capitalist countries. So all of this isn't to say that tariffs would have absolutely no effect at all, but that tariffs can only save jobs in the very short term by stopping a surge of imports and keeping a local market dominated by local business. But in the slightly longer term, as employers introduce new technology, as they restructure their workplaces, or as they respond to depressed market conditions by lowering wages or firing workers, the tariffs don't end up protecting jobs, they just protect the profits of the bosses. So even if they do temporarily work, it's also only in a sectional way and will most likely lead to a contraction and loss of jobs in other industries. That's the second thing I want to start talking about now, that calling for tariffs does adopt a sectional approach to fighting for workers' rights. As I said, tariffs can potentially have that short-term effect on the protected industry, but only at the expense of other sections of the working class. So first of all, they can have negative effects on other industries due to the increased cost of imports. And an example of this is the steel industry in the United States, not this year, but 16 years ago, when George Bush Jr. Erected tariffs on certain steel products, which ended up having fairly disastrous consequences, and he turned away from it pretty quickly. So there was only a very minimal impact on employment in the steel industry. But at the same time, 200,000 jobs were lost in businesses that use steel products that now had to be bought at a higher price. And those other companies now having to pay more for their steel, they don't want to see their profit margins decreasing at the end of a business cycle. So instead, they fire a section of their workforce. And just for context, the entire steel industry in the United States at that time only employed 180,000 people. So more people lost their jobs than were employed in the steel industry. Tariffs can have negative effects on other industries due to retaliatory methods or trade wars. So that's when a country that's been targeted kind of hits back with their own tariffs. And this has been the response to Trump. Pretty much, you know, for every dollar that he's added as a tariff to China or the EU or Canada, etc., those countries have responded with a tariff that should equal roughly the same amount against an American commodity. So this will almost certainly lead to a decline in that industry. So companies will choose to fire a section of the workforce in response to reduced profits, or they may start to prioritise operations in other countries where they won't have to deal with the tax. This was something that was recently threatened by Harley-Davidson in the United States. Finally, tariffs also do often increase the price of commodities. So again, the bosses say now they've got to pay an extra 20% for this thing that they're importing into the country. They don't want to see that 20% come out of their pocket, so instead they'll raise the price of that and push it onto the consumer. This in turn lowers the standard of living for workers. So, you know, cars, food, clothing, electronics, all of these things that many people rely on to live every single day suddenly cost more. And I think that we're not for increased taxes on consumer goods. We're not for working class people having to pay more for the things that they need in life. Okay, so the other argument I have about why the left should not support protectionism is that it entirely identifies the wrong target who is responsible for job losses in the neoliberal period. So it is bosses and not free trade laws that are responsible for unemployment and bad wages. So adopting the strategy of economic nationalism and advocating protectionism relies on the assumption that what is good for the boss will in turn be good for the workers in their firm. So it's a response to neoliberalism that focuses on class collaboration, not class struggle. And this strategy, I think, has been fairly disastrous for workers. So the main way that jobs have been undermined over the past few decades has been through internal industry restructurings. Restructuring is a kind of very vague term, but essentially what it means is a new plan set out for the workplace by the boss where they, you know, might introduce a speed up. So suddenly you are told that you have to be producing, you know, 20 pens an hour instead of 10 pens an hour, or that you will lose your job. Restructures can also be, you know, firing a whole section of the workforce and replacing those people with, you know, workers from a labour hire company or something that you have to pay less and that don't have the same benefits in their agreements. Or it can actually just be, you know, a massive cut in wages, trying to drive the union off the worksite, a whole series of things. So this is what the bosses are doing in practice, but they have been, you know, it's not what they say they're going to set out to do. So they've used the threat of offshoring or the difficulties that they face from foreign competition to try and blackmail workers and more specifically the unions into accepting the restructures. So they argue that if there's not a serious shake-up of wages, conditions and employment levels, the company will either go bust or they will be forced to move their operations overseas, and then everyone will lose their job. I think quite shamefully, a lot of unions have fallen in right behind this line. and ended up being the kind of people on the front line trying to sell it to workers that they are supposed to represent. Okay, so this, so this was, I've kind of already mentioned that. So, yeah, in the 1980s when there was a real assault in the manufacturing industries, this was taken up by the unions quite a lot, so both calling for tariffs but also arguing that, you know, the economy is not doing so well anymore. We actually do have to start accepting a whole bunch of these measures that the boss is proposing, or everyone here is going to lose their jobs. And I think, unfortunately, this strategy has not changed over the past few decades, despite the fairly disastrous consequences. So recently, and this is not specific, this example is not specifically about tariffs, but it is kind of a form of economic nationalism, and I think the different strategies within that follow the same logic. So in 2015 at BlueScope Steel at Port Kembla, which is just about 2 hours south of Sydney, the company cried poor following a glut in the global steel production and a subsequent drop in prices. So they demanded $200 million in savings, much of which the union offered to them through 500 job losses and a 3-year wage freeze. They also requested a pretty serious handout from the government. So 2 years later, and in the second half of 2017, the company's net profits actually increased by 8.5% to $78.2 million. The CEO received a bonus of $495,000 on top of his annual $1.03 million salary, but the wages of BlueScope Steel workers remain frozen. All right, so the final argument against protectionism is that it also has the kind of byproduct of fostering racism and division towards workers of other nations. So it's pitting the international working class against one another. So again, instead of seeing the cause of unemployment and depressed wages as a global capitalist class that is interested only in maximising profit margins, workers in the West are told that their worsening living conditions have been caused by Chinese workers stealing their jobs. So this is kind of the same logic that leads unions to argue against immigration on the basis that foreign workers will enter the country and steal their jobs. I think economic nationalism, Aussie jobs for Aussie workers, etc., cannot be divorced from kind of straight-up nationalism and racism. Again, the example with the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement from before is a good one. I think this is even more concerning at a time like the present, when there is a growing anti-China scare campaign that's being pushed from the top of society. So recently, Richard Trumka, who's the president of the AFL-CIO, in March he put out a statement in response to the first round of tariffs on steel and aluminium. And in that he said, for years we have called attention to the predatory practices of some steel exporting countries. Such practices hurt working people and cheat companies that produce in the United States. We applaud the administration's efforts today to fix the problem. That administration is talking about is the Trump administration. So it should go without saying that Trump's tariffs have absolutely nothing to do with helping the American working class. His administration's Buy American, Hire American economic nationalism has to be understood as part of his broader political and economic agenda that's about boosting corporate profits, most notably last year with an enormous company tax cut, and boosting domestic manufacturing to build capacity for the war drive aimed at China. Also, I think it's about stoking racism towards migrants and Chinese workers to foster this sense of national unity and likely to prepare the population for a looming showdown between China and the United States. So Trump has been very open that the tariffs are largely based around industries important to a war effort. Steel, aluminium, the auto industry, and that the others are about attempting to curb China's growth. And also, more recently, curbing the growth of allies like Germany, kind of the EU as a whole. It's about trying to reassert American dominance is still very real, but to kind of further assert American dominance on the global stage. So this is in the context of a ramping up of anti-Chinese racism that pits the Chinese government and the population together as this kind of existential threat to all Americans. So one example of this is the Trump administration's recent announcement of new restrictions on visas for people from China, including international students who are studying in some fields of science and technology. So it's the conscious construction of a kind of us versus them mentality to justify an increasingly aggressive imperialist stance towards China. And actually in January this year, the Defence Secretary, James Mattis, identified China as the new number one primary concern of American national security. So it's a kind of war on terror, that's done. Now we've got this new big rival that we need to confront. Part of that is through a kind of rearmament phase, but it's also through economic warfare. So you can see in this context that the American labour movement gushing with praise for Trump's economic policies and the racism really that underlies them is, you know, instead of trying to organise a resistance to the far-right billionaire, who will only continue the downward trajectory of wages and the obscene inequality in the United States. You can see what a dead-end strategy this is. It's also worth saying that this kind of same dynamic is at play here in Australia. So as a junior partner in the US alliance, the Australian ruling class is also adopting a more aggressive stance towards China. The consequence of this has been a recent surge of anti-Chinese rhetoric and policies from the media and the government. All of this hysteria about buying Australian land, you know, talking about Chinese international students as though they're this fifth column coming into the country to try, you know, steal scientific research, etc. It's all part of this kind of new global imperialist tension. Okay, so racism has been used throughout the whole history of capitalism as a conscious tool to divide workers, especially during a time of crisis. So we need to reject racist scapegoating of foreign workers for the very real decline in working and living conditions, or the same neoliberal strategy that has bred this decline will remain by identifying the wrong target, by accepting that, you know, workers in a kind of foreign land are responsible for your increasingly depraved living standards. It does nothing to start to organise a resistance and a struggle against the actual people who are responsible for, well, now stagnating wages in this country, stagnating wages after 26 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Okay, so I've devoted most of the discussion here to protectionism, as this is the main thing that the left has been campaigning against. Just devoted most of the discussion to protectionism because the left has been spending many years campaigning against free trade and the evils that go along with it. But I think that there is a danger that in response to the European far right and Trump's economic nationalism, a defence of free trade zones presented in a kind of internationalist way. And we've seen this recently with debates about the EU and Brexit. So free trade zones are not about breaking down national barriers between people. Instead, they are about establishing the optimum conditions for exploitation on a global scale. You know, free movement of people within the EU was about opening up a low-paid labour market from the south and the east to head up to the north. And you could see with the refugee crisis beginning in 2015, that's continuing still today. free movement of people does not apply when there is some kind of humanitarian crisis. It's just about what is in the interests of European capital. The free trade agreements have also been about opening up markets in the third world to international capital via institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. These have left these countries devastated while enriching foreign capital and a small domestic ruling class. So there's absolutely nothing to defend in any of this. Okay, so I want to conclude with laying out what approach I think we should take. So first of all, I think we need to reject the idea that what is good for bosses is good for workers. I think we need to reject the class collaborationist approach to trade unionism and also to challenge racist explanations of depressed working conditions. But I think we also need to recognise that we have suffered what is approaching now 40 years of relative defeat. So there's been 40 years now of a boss's offensive which has eroded social services, wages, working conditions all around the world. And the only way that all of this will be reversed is through struggle. So there are some immediate strategies that can be taken to confront redundancies. Company or industry-wide strikes have had success in saving jobs. The Maritime Union of Australia is one example of that here. But a lot of these have failed due to isolation, just remaining within the one company or the one industry. Also, if a company refuses to budge, a strong enough union movement could demand, instead of governments just throwing money to capitalists who then just keep it to themselves and continue to fire a section of the workforce, as happened with the auto industry here, instead the union movement could demand that section of industry be nationalised and that all the jobs should be secure. But confronting the problems of redundancies and unemployment, etc., I think really can't be a sectional problem. So national, also international working class solidarity is absolutely key. So supporting similar movements, labour movements internationally, for which there is historical precedent. It might sound a bit far-fetched in the kind of current political climate that we're living in, but again, the precursor to the Maritime Union, the Waterside Workers' Federation, had a long history of boycotts to support international struggles, including boycotting products coming from South Africa under apartheid and refusing to load ships that were heading to Vietnam to fight in the war there. So these things are possible, and there's no low-wage growth model anywhere if workers in China and other countries are struggling against their conditions. But finally, I think we need to recognise that the political basis, we need to recognise what is the real political basis for the current turn towards protectionism. That the strategy of Trump to end his administration, which is filled out with quite scary far-right war hawks, their strategy to confront the rising power of China is to be more aggressive, to assert themselves more on the international stage, and the economic warfare in the form of tariffs is just, you know, part of an early phase of this. And this is likely to lead to straight-out traditional military warfare as well. So in this context, we need to recognise that Chinese workers are not the enemy. Instead, it is the Australian government, the American government, the Australian bosses who are the enemy, and workers all around the world, no matter what wages they're being paid, who are part of the global answer.